Commonwealth.
Mr. Farley, Ms. Tyson, have you had a chance to sign the sign-in sheets?
Yes, sir, we have.
Mr. Farley?
Please, the court. I'm ready to depart.
Do you wish to reserve any of your time for rebuttal?
3 minutes, please.
All right. You may begin when you're ready.
But please, the court. I'm Reginald Barley, and I represent Charles Girard in this appeal from the King William Circuit Court. He was charged and convicted of unlawfully possessing a firearm by a felon. The sole issue in this case relates to a document out of Nassau, New York, indicating that Mr. Girard had been sentenced to something in New York. This is the first case that I have seen, and I will say that my appeals are very limited, but the first case that I have seen in which all of the government's cases, at least the Commonwealth's cases, support reversal of the trial course. They cite in their case.
Now let's cut to Chase.
Yes, sir.
It seems that the question, as I see it, is how much research or investigation a trial court can do, or how much judicial notice one can take over certain things. In other words, I think everyone will agree that your client was convicted of something in another jurisdiction.
I would disagree with that,
okay,
Judge.
No. Okay.
I would disagree with that simply because in another jurisdiction he was sentenced. If you will look at that order, it does not even say there was a finding.
But doesn't a sentence presuppose a conviction?
You're surmising. And that surmise and conjecture, which the Supreme Court, in all the cases cited by myself and by the Commonwealth, says you must reject in Preston, in Palmer, and McMillan.
Mr. Barley, my understanding of the record, and you correct me if I'm wrong, is the document was admitted into evidence without objection.
It was objected to, Judge.
Objected to on a very specific grounds as to what it proved, but not objected to that it was received in evidence. Isn't that correct?
No. If you look at pages 20 and 21 of the appendix, and if we look at pages 20 and 21 of the appendix, clearly we object to its admissibility, we object to its admissibility, saying that it's a transcript and it is not in order and it does not comport with 8.01389A1 of the code. We made those specific objections, and they're noted on pages 20 and 21 of the appendix. Pages 23. I'm looking at the pages of the transcript. I'm sorry. On pages 23 and 24. Of the appendix, it clearly indicates that the objection is there. I said it is not in order. The statute says order. It does not say transcript. It does not say an indictment. The statute says order, Judge. And then we go on to page 24, and the court asks, is your objection withdrawn? And I said no.
But whether you objected or not, you lost the objection, and that is not an assignment of error.
Well, even
so that issue has been decided, and it's really not before us. We have to assume that the order was properly admitted in evidence. The question before us, the assignment of error, is whether it proved beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant was a felon.
And it does not.
Okay. So, but don't you agree that the order is in evidence? You lost the objection. You didn't appeal the objection. So for our purposes here today, the order was properly admitted in evidence.
I'm not going to concede that, but I understand what you're saying, Judge.
Counsel, let me go back to what you were saying. On page, getting back, I'm trying to find what you're making reference to. I'm looking at the appendix pages 19 to 20. Appellant stated that he had no, quote, no objection to the order, but did object to the additional supporting documents, exhibits 2 and 3, arguing that they did not comport with the statute, where it only says certified orders. That's a quote from the record from you at appendix page 19. Are you disavowing that statement?
Yes, sir, because we went on to later object to it. If you look at the subsequent pages, as they sought to have admitted, if anything, that objection was withdrawn in light of the further objections that we made, which are noted on pages 23 and 24.
Okay, but then further you say, quote, Judge, we do not have an objection to the order, certificate of disposition, because the statute, code section 8.01-389A1, it is complied with by the Commonwealth in this instance. But you say you disavow that position.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Where is the specific disavow?
Well, there's not a specific disavow, but I think that the language of the objections that we subsequently made, as noted on pages 23 and 24, where the court asked if I continue to object to it under 8.01391, and I said no.
Right, but you had conceded that it didn't just... Your original objection was that the statute only allows in orders. Then the judge says 801389... Mr. Kite references A1, and then you volunteer, Judge, it does say records, I am sorry, meaning that it covers more than orders. So what is the objection at that point? Because you conceded that the statute applies to government records, and at least I didn't see in the record any objection that this wasn't a government record.
Let me say this, even if the objection was withdrawn, we still get to the sufficiency of the evidence in this case itself. Which is a primary issue which both the Commonwealth and I agree is before this court at the time.
Is it your position that the only way you can prove a prior conviction is by introduction of the order of conviction?
We have to have introduction of some kind of indicia from the trial court indicating that there was a conviction of a felony.
Okay.
We do not have a finding in this court, in this case.
You have a certificate from the clerk that her records, a review of her records, indicates that the defendant pled guilty to the crime of attempted criminal possession of a weapon third degree, citing Penal Law 1110-265-02. And that the defendant was sentenced and then it gives the crime and it gives the sentence. What is it about that doesn't establish that he was convicted of a felony?
What is there about it? There is nothing about it that establishes that he was convicted of a felony. Judge Petty, I will submit that the argument that you are making, at least the question that you are raising, were the same points that the Supreme Court in Palmer, Preston, and McMillan rejected.
But those cases were dealing with court orders.
Yes.
And court orders are admissible under a different statute. They're admissible under 17.1-123. And the Supreme Court has held that in looking at 8.01-389 and trying to reconcile it with 17.1-123, it held that the latter applies to orders, the former applies to other records of a court. Right. Here we have another record. This is not an order, I agree with you, but it is a record of that circuit court that is admissible under the 8.01389. So those cases that you cite, you know, they involve lacking a judicial signature, for instance. That's authentication under a different statute.
Well, even under Preston, Judge Petty, in that case we had a signed order. In McMillan, we had a signed order. In each of those cases, we had signed orders, and each time, there was not a specific adjudication of guilt of a felony. In each one of those cases, there was a finding, but not an adjudication.
Mr. Barley, I just want to make sure,
yes,
I understand where we are. The order that the certificate of disposition is in evidence. Would you concede that it makes that a reasonable fact finder could reasonably conclude that he was convicted of something?
No.
A guilty plea is not a conviction?
No, because if we look at statutes in Virginia, 18.251, under that statute, there can be a finding and a person can be sentenced in order to perform community services work, without there being an adjudication of guilt.
Actually, that's a little bit off the statement. It's there, the adjudication principle in an 18.2-251 disposition is that the facts are sufficient for finding, but the finding is withheld.
Yes.
Okay, so that's a little different from what we're talking about.
Well, we do not need, we have in 18.2-251, there is a plea.
Well, are you aware of anybody under an 18.2-251 disposition who got 6 months imprisonment? Because the document also says he got that. I mean, is there any conclusion that can be drawn that he wasn't convicted of something? Separate question of whether it's a felony.
Yes, sir.
But is it? Can there? I don't see how that can be read as to he wasn't convicted of something.
He was. Yes, I will acknowledge that he was convicted of something. Yes, sir.
Okay, and we know that something was Public Law 110-265-02, E, F. That's what it says, doesn't it?
That's what it says.
Okay. Is there any problem with a judge confronted with a law from another state looking up the law? Could certainly do it for a Virginia statute.
Well, I think that where we are is it leaves us to conjecture in this particular instance of what the judge found and what he convicted him of.
But we're not looking at the certificate of disposition in isolation. The judge is looking at this, that the certificate of disposition in conjunction with your client's admission that he was convicted of a crime in New York. He just wasn't sure what he was convicted of. Doesn't his admission supply the element that you suggest is lacking in the certificate?
Well, but then there is his testimony in court. And his testimony in court was that he thought he was convicted of a misdemeanor.
But he admits he was convicted. That's the one thing that you're arguing is omitted from the certificate of disposition. So doesn't his testimony and his statement to the police supply the missing element that you suggest is lacking in the certificate?
Missing element?
Conviction.
But it does not.
He admits that he was convicted. He didn't say it was taken under advisement. He says, I was convicted. And then we look at the certificate of disposition, and it cites the offense, and all of the offenses under that penal law are felonies. So what doesn't the trial judge have before him?
The ambiguity, again, becomes is found in the certificate itself, because each one of those sections of the Code of Virginia cites weapons, and it indicates on different kinds of weapons. Here, the certificate from New York State it says weapon not disclosed. We don't even know if there was even a weapon.
But as long as he was convicted of all of the crimes in 265.02 are felonies, all of the offenses, as far as I can tell. So there's nothing in there that says misdemeanor.
Judge, I will say this. I think that's an argument that the Supreme Court has rejected in three different cases, in all cases cited by the Commonwealth in this case.
Mr. Riley, you're starting to get into your rebuttal time, and I'll give you a little bit more because we've been asking you pretty hard. But one question I'm going to want you, that I'm confident will be subject to rebuttal, given the questions of my husband, Ms. Tyson, isn't really all of this about is whether the EF and the statutory site sufficient for us to conclude it's sufficient for the trier of fact to conclude it was a felony?
I think that's a valid question.
Ms. Tyson.
May it please the court, and I realize I'm going to have to answer that question. But what I do want to clear up one thing first, because I think this is important. And I understand that Mr. Barley was present at the trial and I was not. I've got the record that I must rely on, and this court must rely on that record too. And the way I read the record, there was a different objection made to the certificate of disposition and then to some ancillary documents. And the only objection to the certificate of disposition that I see in this record has to do with sufficiency of the evidence. It's the ancillary
documents. So in other words, what you're saying is that there was clearly an objection to Exhibits 2 and 3.
Well, to 2, because okay. Exhibit 2 are the waiver of indictment, the information, the prior conviction, those documents that were not the certificate of disposition, which was Exhibit 1. My reading of the record is the only objection to Exhibit 1 was that it was insufficient, not that it was otherwise inadmissible. And so
What's your position with regard to Exhibit 3? Do you take the position that there was an objection or that there was not?
I don't believe there was, because those were just the statutes, although I could be wrong. He may have objected to that in... he may have objected to it. The court took judicial notice and then admitted those statutes.
But you would rely on apparently what was stated at trial. Judge, we do not have an objection to the order because the statute is complied with in this instance, which then relates to Exhibit 1.
Correct. And then you'll see following on page 20 of the appendix, he says, our only objection, and we don't want to waive this, is to the sufficiency. That's on page 20 of the appendix. My reading of 23 and 24, we're still talking about the ancillary documents
Assuming for the sake of our discussion that there were proper objections to everything. So
okay.
For the sake of discussion, what ability or authority does a trial judge have with regard to essentially supplementing the proffer of evidence that this is indeed a felony conviction? Can a judge go to the statutes, dig it out? What can a judge do basically as part of his fact-finding responsibility?
Your Honor, I think what the judge did here was absolutely proper. And the reason I think that is that I think a judge might have that same requirement even if this were in Virginia. That there are times where the law has changed, and not to make light of this at all, but there are times that I have certainly seen that I wish a court or the lawyers in the courtroom had taken that extra look at the statute to see what kind of felony or misdemeanor that it was.
To what extent, though, can a judge inquire to essentially supplement the factual predicate supporting the case?
I think that it's that whether it's a Virginia statute or it's the New York Penal Code, those are public documents that are subject to research, just like any other information. Even a case, a court could look at that.
Ms. Tyson, on our possession of weapons after having been convicted of a felony statute in Virginia, there's different mandatory minimum sentencing provisions if one has been convicted of a crime, a defined crime of violence under 17, as defined in 17.1705.
Yes.
If that's the charge, can the trial judge, when presented with the evidence, look at 17.1705 to determine if it's one of the list, if the conviction's for one of the listed crimes?
Absolutely. That is the code is available for the court to inquire. And given that this is a document from New York, a court has to have that same ability. Because, and I think I noted this in the brief, if you were a lawyer in New York, you would know this. You would know EF means E felony. You would know DF means D felony.
Should we assume that a Virginia judge knows that a EF is a felony in New York and a DF is a felony?
No, but the point being, if we took our order from this case and someone in New York was looking at our order, they would see a little F in parentheses and a little M in parentheses. They wouldn't see any description of whether this crime is a felony or a misdemeanor. And that judge in New York would have the same ability to look and see if that was a felony or a misdemeanor in Virginia.
What case law can you point to suggest that the judge does have the ability to do independent research to support the idea that this is indeed a felony?
Your Honor, I can't think of a case standing here before you, but I do think that just as there would be no argument that a judge couldn't open the Virginia code book to check to see is this still a Class 2 misdemeanor or has the legislature changed that. Just as a judge could do that research before making a determination in a case in Virginia, a judge can do that with a public law that's out for everyone to see, is available, and in this case, the lawyer, the prosecutor, provided that for him. But it's easy. You can get it off of electronic.
Ms. Tyson, you're not contending that if they just said he was convicted of something, the judge could go do the research, but saying he was convicted of this particular crime, judges look up statutes all the time. That's
correct. That is my point. And I think this may take us into another area, and I don't want to leave this one too soon if I have not answered the question. The question, was EF enough? Was this enough? If there was nothing else, would this be enough to satisfy that it's a felony? And You know, if you're in New York, yes, it is, because the lawyer in New York will know that an EF is an E-felony. For the court in Virginia, without doing some sort of additional research to know that that is a felony, our judge said that's not enough. Judge Hoover said, that's not enough, Mr. Prosecutor. I'm going to need something more than just you telling me.
In this case, the trial judge used the term judicial notice. Was there some imprecision in the use of that term for what he did?
It may be. But fortunately for the Commonwealth, those statutes were actually admitted as exhibits in this case. Yeah, and so,
can you help me with those statutes? In my eyes, are not what they used to be. But it looks to me like the statute, 265.02,
correct,
says that criminal possession of a weapon in the third degree is a Class D felony.
Correct.
Okay. Then he was convicted of an attempt.
Correct.
So I look at what an attempt to commit a Class D felony is, and that's statute 110.05, sub 5. It says Class D felony.
Mm-hmm. A Class E felony when the crime attempted is a Class D. So since the major, the 265.02 is a D, if you attempt a D, it's an E.
So why do we care what EF means? Why don't we, the court can take judicial notice of the statutes of New York. The statute of New York seems to tell me that regardless of EF, an attempted criminal possession of a firearm is a felony.
Yes,
it is.
It is a felony. That is correct.
Okay, I didn't miss anything.
No, that is correct. And here's the difference between the case that we have and the cases of McMillan and Palmer and Overbay. In those cases, if you look at, and all of those were the juvenile cases, when you look there, you really cannot tell precisely for what crime the person was found delinquent or found guilty, for lack of a better phrase. And that is the criticism from the Supreme Court in each one of those cases. The person may have been convicted of something, and in fact was convicted of something, and received some sort of sentence. But for instance, in McMillan, there's a finding that the evidence was sufficient and the plea was accepted and he was released from detention. You can't tell precisely what crime the defendant was convicted of. That's different here because we know he pled guilty to a particular crime. He was sentenced for that crime.
Let me focus in on another question that I have. 8.01-389.
Yes.
I hope we agree that that's the statute under which this record was admitted.
Yes.
Not the 17.1-123, because that's court orders. Okay, 801.389 talks about the records of a judicial proceeding. Correct?
It does.
Suppose the clerk had just written a letter and said, I'm the clerk of the court. I've reviewed the records. He was convicted of a felony. Very truly yours, clerk of court. Attest. Would that be admissible? Because that's kind of what this is. This is just for your information, my records show he was convicted of a felony.
And I'm a witness. I have set my hand, affixed my official seal
but
to that.
It's really not a record of the court or a judicial record of a judicial proceeding. It's a record of the...
And any other official record. If you keep reading, though, the records of any I'm reading in A1, records of any judicial proceeding, and any other official record of any court. And let me say this about 801.389.
But is this the record of the court?
It is.
Or is this a summary of the records of the court?
It is a record of New York. And here is the point that I would like to make about 801.389. The fact that we have a full faith and credit provision in 801.389, I think recognizes that other states don't function the way we do. They have different means of keeping their records, and they have different ways that they do orders, and certainly from some other cases from this court, we have seen other state jurisdictions that keep mounds and mounds of paper. In New York, this is how this is done. And just as we experience, or we hope that we have full faith and credit for our orders, 801.389 recognizes that even if another state does things differently than we do, if this is the official record from that state, then we're going to give it full faith and credit here.
But it's not the record. It's an abstract of the record.
Except
it's basically the court saying, I've looked at my records and this is what they contain. That's my, but it's almost a hearsay problem.
And fortunately, that for me, that objection was not made at trial, although it was raised in the brief. And frankly, my first argument was that that was waived because there was no hearsay objection to the order. Going back to what I was saying about if we read from page 20 through about page 24, there is a distinction between the objection made to the ancillary documents and the objection that was made to the certificate of disposition. And the only objection to this certificate was that it was insufficient.
Suppose let's take this out of the criminal context. Suppose we're talking about some property dispute, and the clerk of court sends this up and just says, the records of my court contain a deed that says that John Smith owns 10 acres of Black Acre. I mean, that's kind of what this is. It's an abstract of the contents of the record. Would that kind of thing be admissible?
Well, that's
under,
not...
Under 801-389?
But see, that's not the way we do it in Virginia. We have a different method. But if that's the way that the records are kept in New York, then it would be a record.
But it's not a copy of the deed. It's just a summary by the clerk of what the records contain.
It is a record that's kept in New York under the way New York keeps its records, and it is under the hand of the clerk and affixed with the official seal.
I certify that it appears from an examination of the records on file. So the records on file prove, there is a record on file that shows he was convicted, but that's not included in this. This isn't a record on file. It's a
Except isn't it logical to conclude, given that it's given a disposition number afterwards, that it is now on file in New York, that they kept a copy of it, and that's why they give it certificate of disposition number 15401. But on some level, isn't all of this academic, because this was in evidence, and so it doesn't matter how it got there. It doesn't matter if it should have been. The only question is, what conclusions can we draw from it?
I believe that's correct. But I also think 389 recognizes that other states do things differently than we do. And we're going to allow other states to do things the way they want to do them, and we're going to recognize the validity. And it was recognized here. I do want to make an additional point, which is, although this case is not exactly like Waller, because in Waller, the defendant actually testified that he had a prior felony, not a violent felony, but a prior felony. But here we do have, in addition to the documentary evidence, when, and this is on page 19 of the appendix in the summary from the prosecutor, at the time of the arrest and the processing, the deputy says to the defendant in this case, "I see on your record you have a felony. What's that about?" The defendant stated his felony conviction in New York State was for a stolen gun related to his stepson. So we have an admission, and this was important to the fact finder. At page 45 and 46, this was a bench trial. And
so what you're suggesting, and I'm glad that you made reference to that, what you're suggesting is that the compilation of evidence in this case was more circumstantial than direct. In other words, we have the document from New York, which, as the statute says, provides prima facie evidence of a conviction. Then you have the defendant's alleged statements that he was convicted of an offense that sounds like the one that was he was convicted of in New York. And then you add on to the fact that the judge is looking at the New York statute and making the determination that this is likely a felony based upon his reading of the statute.
I think all of those things. I think that the documentary evidence itself is sufficient. That is my position. I think that the circumstantial evidence of the admission of the defendant supports the court's finding that it was a felony.
What I'm having some problem is that the judge said that he's taking judicial notice of this. And I'm having a problem with this idea of saying that he took judicial notice, because the term judicial notice, and I looked it up, is defined as a doctrine which enables a judge to accept a fact without the need of a party to prove it through the evidence. The underlying portion of this case, it must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, is that this is a felony. He can take judicial notice of certain things unlike this, but judicial notice is not the proper way to address this, is it?
Even if it's not the proper way to address it, you know, normally we see judicial notice about what was the weather that day,
yeah.
So things like that that are not... But that's a little bit of research, too. This is a little bit of legal research, which is perfectly fine, whether it be in Virginia or not.
Typically, we take judicial notice, say, if we were in Richmond, and we have a circuit judge sitting in Richmond, and he took judicial notice that the capital is in Richmond because he lives here.
Correct.
Those things you don't need to prove because he has independent knowledge of that. But here the judge did not have independent knowledge of what the circumstances were in New York. He actually had to go do some research.
No, but a judge in Richmond could take judicial notice after looking at when the General Assembly came to town or when they left to know dates of that kind of thing. That would be an appropriate use of judicial notice. I see that my time has expired. Based upon the documentary evidence and the admission, which the trial court found to be significant, we would urge this court to affirm. Thank you.
There are certain facts.
I'm going to give you an extra minute, Mr. Barley.
Yes, sir. Thank you. In this particular instance, we rely heavily on Palmer, Commonwealth versus Palmer. And the reason we did that is because the facts are almost indistinguishable. Palmer was charged with felonies. He was sentenced by the trial court as though it was a felony. The Supreme Court said that was not enough. Here we have a case in which it appears that Mr. Girard was sentenced under a felony, but there is no finding that he was convicted of a felony.
Well, Mr. Bartlett, let me ask this. Let's forget all about the stuff that came out of New York.
Yes, sir.
It wasn't admitted.
Yes, sir.
There was a proffer of evidence made to the court. There was no objection to the proffer of evidence made to the court. And that proffer says the defendant stated that his felony conviction was for a stolen gun related to his stepson. Why isn't that admission by the defendant, standing alone, sufficient to prove that he was convicted of a felony?
Because you still have to have an order of adjudication from a court.
Is there any case that you can tell me that says that the only way that you can prove a felony conviction is by the order of conviction?
That's exactly what the Supreme Court says in Palmer, McMillan, and Preston.
No, in Palmer, McMillan, and Preston, did the defendant get on the stand and say, yeah, all of those were felony convictions?
Well, no.
We're drawing here.
And we don't.
Would that have changed those cases if the defendant had said, yes, all of those were felony convictions?
If he had said that in the cases in which he had been convicted, yes. But that is in New York. And so that does not change things.
Let's make the case less complicated. Suppose we had a case where everything was in Virginia. The defendant had a prior circumstance. I'm not going to call it a conviction. He had a prior circumstance in Virginia. And he was charged with the same offense that he's charged here. And for whatever reason, and we know why criminal defendants do things, but for whatever reason, he concedes that he has been convicted of prior felonies. Would the government still need to bring in certified copies to prove those convictions, or would defendant's concession be enough to support a conviction in that case?
I don't know, to be honest with you.
I appreciate that.
All right. And in this particular instance, Judge, I will say this, that in making his findings, the trial court did not go back to any of the independent admissions that were made by Mr. Girard. He relied solely on the statute and solely on the certificate of disposition. That's all. If you look at his findings, that's exactly what he states.
If there are no other questions.
That's all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll come down and recount.